good evening, everybody. I admire the survival strategy of trees. I've been reading lately that even though you might think that trees are individual organisms, they actually, like in a forest, their root systems are connected. So that if something comes and, you know, attacks one tree, it sends out a message to the other trees that they need to put out chemicals and things like that to defend themselves. And so there's this huge invisible community under the ground and in the canopy that means trees are connected and they help each other survive. And if there was in a struggle, my weapon of choice would be laughter. And my battle name is Pamelopoulos. And I'm going to now introduce you to the co-ringleader of the evening, Kelly.
Hi. Oh, this is my first time using a microphone in a very long time. But I'm Kelly Mariska. I am a social worker by day and an improv performer by night. And I work here at the East End Cooperative Ministry. Who inspires me most absolutely has to be the people that I serve here. Just the struggles they go through every day, the barriers that they overcome just to survive every day, to live every day, to get food on the table. I definitely admire all the struggles and the work and everything they go through to just make it in life. If struggle were an animal, it for me would be a sloth, bad depression sloth, and survival would definitely be the octopus. Did you know that the octopus can actually fit itself into like a space the size of a walnut? It can get super, super, like, it's crazy. if throughout the night, I'm also going to be collecting any papers that you guys want to anonymously also say some of your answers. All right.
And if you turn in a paper and we don't get to read it because of time or whatever, we're planning to put these up anonymously on the websites for Storybergen Public Source so you can see things there. So the way the evening will work is it's divided into two parts, and we'll start out with music and we'll have some stories. Then we're going to have an audience activity, and then we'll have the second part of the show, which is some more music and working on the activity, and then storytellers, and then a final wrap-up. So first up are our musicians. It's Matthew Petronco, and he's playing the saxophone and the recorder, and Aaron LaWinta on the guitar. Let's give him a round of applause. Thank you.
All right, we have some wonderful responses from you guys, so I have to read a couple that I pulled out. I really like this. Everyone had such different answers. This is wonderful. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be a peace treaty, and a plant whose survival strategies I admire is not the one that sat on my windowsill. Terrible survival skills.
All right. So our first teller this evening is Reverend Kelly Wilde, who spends her time doing work, 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 boards, family, having fun with family and friends, just a normal life. Too many people have inspired her. There's too many to name. All of the wonderful men and women that have allowed her into their lives to walk beside them in their struggles. If struggle were an animal, it would be a caterpillar. If survival were an animal, it would be a butterfly. In battle, her weapon of choice would be love. Her name would be kindness. And a plant whose survival strategy she admires are the bristlecone pines. Reverend Kelly?
Evening, folks. How many of you have been to one of these before? Oh, good. So only a few people will know what to expect, and I'm good with the rest of you because I've never done one of these. So I don't know what to expect either. But they convinced me to tell a story about struggle. It was something that they actually had really convinced me to do because I was struggling with me telling a story about struggle because it's one of those, you know, I've had some, but you know, with the work that I do, I look around the folks that we work with here, and I'm like, yeah, my struggles don't even compare to the struggles of some folks. So I almost felt like I was a fraud to come up here and talk about stories of struggle and survival. And then as we worked through this, there was something that actually became quite clear to me that I think is important by looking around this room, most of us should struggle with. And so I'll get to that and you'll understand what I mean. About 12 years or so ago, I ended up in seminary. Surprised me, like it surprised a lot of people that knew me. And in one of the classes, we read a book called The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Has anybody read that book? Yeah, it was actually somewhat life-changing for me. So for those of you that haven't read the book, let me just give you a little background about it. It's a story that's set right after World War II, and it's about a little black girl who was fostered by a white family after her alcoholic father raped her and burned the house down. Picola, which is the name of this little girl, she faces again and again and again in this book the feelings of being ugly because of her dark skin, and her thoughts of she would be beautiful if she only had blue eyes. So in reading this story, you know, what kept coming up again and again and again was that whiteness was good and blackness was bad. Blonde hair and blue eyes were what was normative, is what people strived to have, what was considered to be beautiful. And in reading this book, what kept coming back to me was that the ugliness of racism, and that thinking that those without blue eyes or those with dark skin were somehow not as beautiful as somebody that might be blonde hair, blue-eyed, and white. So I'm sitting in this class and we're reading this book week after week after week. I was one of the few white students in this class. I was the only woman with blonde hair and blue eyes in this class and just kept struggling with this book. And as we're reading this and talking about this, you know, I sat there and felt like the entire room is looking at me, going, this is a story about you being, you know, not a in a good way, not a good person, that all the racism that this world is felt like it was falling on me. And so I finally asked the professor if I could talk to him because this was becoming very emotionally difficult for me. And being the wonderful man that he is, said, sure. And I think he kind of knew what I was going to talk to him about because he's a very wise man. And so I schedule an appointment with him. I walk into his office, which was in the basement of the seminary, and he had a couch there, I guess like he was almost a psychiatrist, and in a way he was for me. And the professor is a black man, and again, somebody that I greatly, greatly respect. And so I walk in and I sit down on this couch, which was very low to the ground and just kind of sunk in. I'm thinking, okay, maybe this is indicative of how this conversation's going to go. But he was so kind, so patient, so loving in how he sat there and looked at me as I started to tell him about how I was feeling about this book and that that's not me. That's not who I am. It's not how I think. Again and again with the I, this is not, you know, it's all about me. And he looked at me and said words that changed my life. He looked at me and said, Kelly, it's not personal. Because see, what we were talking about with this book is about white privilege. And I took it to mean that it was on me. It was personal. I was responsible for all of the issues that were out there. And that particular conversation, that class started my struggle with understanding and coming to terms with white privilege. Now, you say that word and a whole lot of people have a whole lot of different reactions from, yeah, it's real, it exists, it's there, to, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no such thing. And so just struggling with that whole battle about what is it? And it's one of those, okay, well, I personally didn't cause and I can't personally fix white privilege. Thinking, am I still responsible to do something, to do what I can to bring attention to it? I don't know. And so my struggle with that topic has been for the last 12 years. And I started to think about the norming of whiteness and the othering of blackness. Those of us that are my age or close to my age, mid-50s, give or take 10 years, will remember Band-Aids that were called flesh color Band-Aids. Well, guess whose flesh the color was? Mine. And I'm thinking, well, isn't that interesting? Because that might just be a few people's flesh, but it's certainly not everybody's flesh color. There was also a crayon in the crown box that was also flesh, and it was peach colored. And so as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking those two things just speak to how whiteness was considered the norm and what people should achieve to be. And it's not like you can change your skin color. And so that kind of continued my thinking on the systemic nature of white privilege and racism. And it was just one of those weird little, I never thought about that before, but I think it speaks volumes to the culture. You know, one of the things that I know that I will never have to worry about, my two sons will never worry about, is getting a DWB. Anybody in here know what a DWB is? Driving while black. Yep. I don't have to worry about that. My sons don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about when my sons leave my house that they may get shot. I don't have to worry about when my sons get pulled over by the police, which they both have been for speeding and a few other things. I don't worry about them being shot just because they were pulled over by the police. White privilege. So all of these examples just kept coming up in my life again and again and again. And it's like, you know what? I don't care what people say. They can deny this exists all they want. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means I don't want to pay attention to it because, like me, I might be personally responsible to fix it if it exists. And then I realized something a little bit later that, and this has been a little more, I'd say over the past four years or so, that what my professor said to me in Kelly, It's Not Personal, I actually want to sit down with him. I talk to him often. I want to sit down with him and have a conversation with him and tell him I now disagree with him. It is personal. It is personal that even though I didn't cause it, it's personal because I need to learn about it. I have a responsibility as a white individual to learn about white privilege. I have a responsibility to act on it, to educate others on it, to speak to it. Because being silent is complicity in the system, and it allows white privilege and systemic racism to continue. Racism is not an issue for people of color. It is an issue for all of us. And this has been my struggle over the past 12 years of getting to the point where I am right now with this needs to continue to be my struggle, is speaking to this issue, speaking to this particular thing. I've taken, not that I'm trying to toot my horn, but, you know, took a white ally class on how I, as a white person, can be an ally to people of color and be able to speak to other folks that may look more like I do about the fact that this does exist. A year ago, almost to the day, it was the first Sunday in February, a friend of mine asked me to preach at her church. Black History Month is February, and she asked me to preach on racism. And so I did a sermon on white privilege in a congregation that looked like I look. Yeah, talk about a lead balloon. It just went boom. After the service, nobody said, I really enjoyed your message, Pastor. Or glad you were here, Pastor. I got a hello, hello, hello. I was like, wow. But my friend wanted me to do that because I get to leave and she can come in and continue the conversation with folks without being the bad guy. Okay, so it sounds like I got this, right? Like I'm good. I understand white privilege. I rail against it. Well, 2 weeks ago, this summer, I'm United Methodist, and most people understand what's going on in the United Methodist Church and the battle within it over human sexuality. And so I am on the side of progressiveness and full inclusion of folks, irrespective of their sexuality. And at our annual conference, the folks that think like I do and have that theology were systematically silenced by the folks that are very conservative. I'm not used to being silenced. In case you couldn't tell, I like to talk. And so I was been really struggling with this since June. You know, I don't even know if I want to stay United Methodist. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to see the people that did that, because you don't silence people. That's just wrong. Everybody has a right to have their voice heard, whether you agree with them or not. And so struggle with this whole thing. And I talked to my district superintendent, who is a Black woman, and I'm telling her this story. And as I'm standing there telling this story, looking at her, I'm thinking, really, Kelly, really? You've been silenced, what, maybe twice in your life? You have been dismissed and disregarded maybe twice in your life? And Dawn, who is my superintendent, is a wonderfully gracious kind, wise woman. And she very kindly talked to me and encouraged me not to let other people dictate what I do, what I don't do. Don't let them in my head rent free, all those things I tell everybody else. But as I left that conversation, I kept thinking to myself, really, you're going to stand there and whine and moan and complain to a Black woman about being silenced once, twice in your life? Really? A little bit of white privilege going on there, don't you think, Kelly? Because Dawn is used to being silenced often, especially in Pittsburgh. And so was convicted about that, and I sent her a text message apologizing to her for my insensitivity and not being aware of, you know, my white privilege and, you know, stop whining and do something about it. So that's just to kind of say that my struggle is not over and the journey continues. And as I say, amen.
Thank you, Reverend Kelly. So the next couple, a person living or dead whose struggle has touched your life in some way, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. If struggle were an animal, it would be a shelter dog. And if survival were an animal, it would be a feral cat. Mm-hmm. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be a cloak of invisibility. I love Harry Potter, I just have to say that. And my name would be Stormy.
Our next teller is Cass Ballantyne. She spends her time caring for her cats and rabbits, enjoying time with her husband, and singing in the Pittsburgh Compline Choir. And a plant whose struggle, she admires her trees and mushrooms, because she suddenly remembered that they both have amazing sort of community networks under the ground. Yes, they do. Yes, awesome. Which she appreciates. All right, so Cass, come on up.
Good evening. Kaleem, could you not, for once, just do what I ask you to do? Imagine me sitting across from Kaleem on a small, child-sized blue plastic chair. He's 9. I'm 27. We sit in my small, colorful classroom, breathing in the scent of pencil shavings and construction paper. And he's sitting at the table, eye to eye with me, having not done what he was supposed to be doing for about half an hour. And he's looking at me with lividity in his eyes, and in the next 30 seconds, he will tell me what he thinks about my request. But first, I have to tell you about when I first met Kaleem. I was teaching in a poor rural elementary school in North Carolina, and each morning as I drove in to North Graham Elementary, I tried to get as hyped up as possible, because in my first year of teaching, I learned that no day would ever go the way I thought it would, so I had to be ready. So as I pulled up, I took a big swig of coffee and put on my best, I'm ready to do this face, and walked into our school. And although we had a pretty low budget, our principal was very creative and made sure we had a very welcoming entryway. So there were big tubes filled with baubles that the kids would put in, like points in Harry Potter every time they did something good. And we had a big fish tank with silvery angelfish. So I turned toward my classroom, passing our gym with its disintegrating linoleum floor, and put my stuff down and rushed up to Caroline to welcome the kids to school, which was my morning duty. And Caroline sort of gives you a sense of the dynamic of our school. A few Honda Odysseys would pull up, but mostly ancient two-door Honda Civics and Oldsmobiles filled with bunches of kids and cigarette smoke. But at the same time, we would usually be dancing because our music teacher would be playing the tambourine to our unofficial school theme song that year, which was Happy by Pharrell. So we're all dancing and welcoming the kids to school. So I was in a pretty good mood by the time I got to my first reading group. So I was a special ed teacher who specialized in small group, specialized curriculum. And so my first group was there and my principal comes by and says, I think we might have a new child with a disability this morning in the third grade. He seems to be struggling and I'm not sure, but maybe you can help. So after I finished my reading group, I ran over to the third grade hall to see what was up. I walked in and Kaleem is sitting 5 feet back from his desk with his arms tightly crossed over his chest, and he's scowling at his new teacher. It's 8 o'clock, bell rang at 7:15, so already it had been a pretty hard day for Kaleem. So I introduced myself and told the teacher that I'd be back once I knew more from his last school. It turns out, once I got the records, that Kaleem had oppositional defiance disorder. If you don't know about ODD, it often presents as stubborn defiance to authority. And in my experience, it seems an adaptation to a life where your own strengths sort of pale in contrast to the expectations of society, and defiance sometimes seems like your only avenue out. So in my experience, it's also an overused label for Black and brown children whose relationships have fallen apart, and instead of healing them, we blame them. But still, whether he had ODD or not, the regular classroom was a difficult place for Kaleem and other kids like him. It was big and busy, and the expectations were high, and very frequently, kids and teachers would accidentally offend him, and he would get very upset. So instead, we went slow and were careful. And all the while, I monopolized any moment I had to build relationship with him. And I did my best to make sure he had more days where he left smiling than storming out. 2 months later, though, I was getting to my last nerve. Kaleem had been with me most of the day for about a month because he had been too aggressive in the regular classroom. And on this particular morning, I'm sitting at my circle table in the teacher nook, working with third graders on literacy, and Kaleem sitting at his own desk for a little bit, working on subtraction. And I can feel the anxiety of teachers sort of coming up into me as I'm sitting there listening to the short vowel sounds. I taught in North Carolina the year after the state legislated that any third grader who could not be shown to be proficient on a multiple choice test by the end of the year would fail the third grade, which was a horror for the children that I worked with. And at the same time, we were coping with new Common Core standards, which meant the proficiency requirement had gone way up. And so the odds were stacked against us. And I would often think about this while I was working. And I just say that to say that I had this aura around me sometimes of worry that sometimes was visible to my kids and made it easier for them to push my buttons, especially when they were stressed out too. So anyways, I'm sitting there trying to keep my group focused on reading while the midday holiday of lunch approached. And I sat in my nook, and I could physically see that Kaleem was starting to struggle with his work. In a couple of seconds, he started loudly banging his pencil on the edge of his desk. And normally, I would have gone over and checked in with him or given him something different to do or invited him to my group. But for whatever reason, that day, I just wanted him to do his work, to learn what he could and let me finish with my group. And I was thinking, you know, he's struggling. The kids at my table are struggling. I'm struggling. All I could think was, we're all struggling, Kaleem. Just try to finish the worksheet. And we finished our lesson, and my other students headed back to their homerooms. And I walked over to Kaleem's table, and I sat down next to him, and I said, coming back to the beginning of our story, Kaleem, could you not just for once do what I ask you to do? He looked at me as though I had betrayed him. And in the same moment, shot up out of his chair and flipped his desk over with all his force. As the pencils and papers and books clattered to the floor and his chair landed on its side a few feet behind him, we both just stood in shocked silence. I won't ever know what Kaleem was thinking at that moment, but I imagine it was something like, who is this lady who was supposed to be helping me? And instead, she's ignoring me. Now I'm probably going to get suspended and my grandma's going to be mad again. And all because this lady who was supposed to help me abandoned me. Whatever he was thinking, he didn't move. He didn't escalate. He just stood, probably waiting to see if I was going to call the principal. And meanwhile, I felt a deep sadness and disappointment in myself. And all my frustration with Kaleem shifted back to me. How could I have asked Kaleem to do something to please me? That is not why I became a teacher. And I suddenly realized more deeply than before that despite all my training and my time with kids, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea how to go from this point in a way that would help him, to heal the hurt that brought him to that moment, to prevent the likely future that he had as a Black boy with behavioral problems, to teach him how to read at a pace that the state would accept. I felt all the fears that I had about teaching and poverty and racism and depleted school budgets and ridiculous laws come down around me the moment before he flipped that table. And so instead, in that moment, when he was coping with a complex and seemingly insurmountable struggle, I distilled it down wrongly to the basic expectation, the contract between adults and children, compliance. So as the last paper floated to the ground, I did the only thing I felt was right. I apologized. Then I asked him if he wanted a hug. He said yes. We stood for a brief moment in my little classroom and shared a short hug that I'll never forget. We both cried a few tears as we picked up the table, the pencils, and the books. And in a few minutes, we just went to lunch. Ultimately, Kaleem didn't make it at North Graham Elementary, at least not in the short term. He became too aggressive in too many situations and needed more support healing his emotional self than our school could provide. He ended up transferring temporarily to the alternative school in our district. And though it was staffed by incredible special educators who I really respected, I was afraid that our failures, my failures, had been a significant stop on his road to what could be for him the school-to-prison pipeline. And I definitely know I felt like part of the problem, even when I was trying my best. I went to have lunch with Kaleem a few times at the alternative school. I would walk in the basement entrance and down the hall to the sterile, pale yellow lunchroom. And despite the dismal decor, he seemed really happy. He seemed like he was okay there, that he felt safe and successful. He was at the alternative school for more than a year, and I was moving to Pennsylvania before he came back to our school. I don't really know what happened to him after that, but I think of him and pray for him frequently. I had learned through Kaleem and many other experiences at the public school that right now too little caring might be going on in schools. I learned that I hadn't been taught, and maybe couldn't be taught, the skills I needed to help children with so many barriers. So when I had to move away from North Carolina, I sought out social work, a new or maybe not so new way of thinking about things. I admit that I lost touch with Kaleem after I left North Carolina, but I think of him and the handful of students I had like him when I teach and research now as a social worker. Now I try to teach people to resist systems and interventions that make kids and parents want to or actually flip tables. I encourage people to develop a worldview that recognizes the myriad of reasons one might be justified to flip a table. Every time I amplify the voice of a parent or a student who has desperately felt like flipping a table but usually just soldiers on, I feel like I'm a little closer to the right thing. But sometimes I really wish we could just flip all the tables and start again. And when I feel like that, my mind goes back to that moment with Kaleem after he flipped his table. I learned in that moment what I know now, which is that although I will never know what I am doing, I have to do something. Thank you.
Thank you, Kes.
All right, a person living or dead whose struggle has touched your life in some way. My grandma. With 13 kids to feed, she took me in at 12 years old, raised me to know good hard work. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be knowledge, and my name would be Braveheart. And a plant whose survival strategies I admire is a weeping willow.
Our next teller is Char. She spends her time loving her family and her community. And the person who's inspired her was an anonymous woman at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting who inspired and identified with her. If struggle were an animal, it would be a snake. If survival were an animal, it would be an Arctic moth. In battle, her weapon is God. And her battle name is Char. And she says, my name is enough. People sing it when they say it. The plant who's survival strategies she admires are sunflowers, and they lean into the sun, and you can spell that either way with an O or a U, for strength, and they give energy to each other. Char, come on up.
Hello, everybody. So I have three rules before we get started. The first rule is feel all your feels. Good friend said that to me. Feel all your feels. And when I say that girl's smart, I want you to say out loud, she's smart. And look for God throughout the story. Yes, look for God. So imagine with me a little girl so abused, so mistreated, so neglected, just really just abused and distorted in her thinking already that she's the saddest, baddest little girl in the land. None of the kids want to play with her. None of the parents want their kids playing with her. She's all alone by herself. There's no place safe for her in her home, in her community, the only safe space is her classroom, her special ed classroom in Carmel Elementary School. She was in special ed for behavior, not for LD or anything like that, because that girl was smart.
She's smart.
She had this wonderful teacher named Ms. Holly, who saw so much potential in her. Ms. Holly saw this girl before she could see herself. Ms. Holly saw this girl coming before she can create a plan in her mind to do something wrong. This little girl, she was all over the place in the classroom, stealing stuff, touching stuff, just doing all kinds of stuff. And Ms. Holly, you know, she saw so much potential in her. She knew that girl was smart.
She's smart.
So Ms. Holly introduced SRAs to this little girl. SRAs are boxes of phonics and stories and just reading comprehension. And in the boxes, there were files of phonics and stories and stuff like that. And each file was color-coded. So this girl knew that each color she went up to, that she was smart. That girl knew she was smart.
She was smart.
So Ms. Holly knew that if she sat this girl down with these SRAs, it would kill two birds with one stone. It would keep her focused, keep her sitting in one seat, and it would just bring all this goodness out of her. And the little girl loved the stories because she was already like a plotter and a planner and thinking and scheming all the time. So reading stories was an amazing thing for her. It was a new world for her. She would discover all these worlds in these stories. So she would blow through these SRAs, and each color, she knew that she was smart, and everybody else knew that girl was smart.
She's smart.
And so every day, every week, every month, year after year, this girl blew through these SRAs and went through each color, all the boxes. And Ms. Holly would have all these boxes out on the file cabinets, and it created so much autonomy in this girl, because she would just get up and get her files out the box and do the work and all, you know, she would just opened up her mind. By the time this girl was in the fifth grade, she had to take a test to determine how smart she was. And so she scored a 12.9, which meant 12th grade, ninth month. She was in a college reading level by the time she was in the fifth grade. That girl was smart.
She's smart.
Yes. And so life happened because her parents were addicts, and so they moved around a lot. So by the time she was in middle school, she struggled with addiction, and she fought a lot. And she was always that girl, you know, who didn't have any friends because she was always new. And by the time she was in high school, it was the same story. Addiction and dereliction took over her life, and all these other issues took over her life, but nothing kept her down, because every school she went to, everything she went through, she always made straight A's. Nothing kept her down because that girl was smart. And she knew she was. Her world started to open. Her mind started to open despite all the things in her life. And she loved education. Ms. Holly sparked something so wonderful in her. Seeds planted in her. She knew she was going to have a future. So by the time she was in the 10th grade, she had to sign out of high school. She decided to sign out of high school and went to Job Corps. Blew through Job Corps in 10 months. She earned her nurse's aide degree, home health aide degree, and her GED. That girl was smart.
She's smart.
By the time she came home from Job Corps, her addiction was still the same, but she was the youngest nurse's aide in McKeesport Hospital. So she worked very hard, worked really hard. But anybody who knows about addiction, it kind of takes over things. So addiction just became real big in her life. Dereliction, jails, institutions, all kinds of stuff happened. But that girl never forgot Ms. Holly. That girl never forgot the seeds that were planted in her. And she remembered God. God walked with her, God talked with her, and she knew God did not forget her. And so in spite of all the things that she went through, she knew how smart she was. God met her in a place where she just knew there was something in her, there were things growing in her, and her life was not going to be over, despite addiction, despite everything she went through. So she made the decision to change her life. And her clean date is February 2nd, 1998. She went to college. In fact, she graduated four times because she knew, everybody knew, that girl was smart.
She's smart.
She has a wonderful family. She's changed her life. Wonderful things have happened in her life. She's come full circle in her life. All the exploitation she went through, the addiction, the dereliction, the trafficking she was caught in, she actually founded an organization that provides aftercare for female victims of exploitation and trafficking. That little girl was me. And because of Ms. Holly, and because of God, more importantly, I'm the woman standing here before you. Thank you.
All right. A person who struggled has touched my life in some way. My sister-in-law, who I took care of as she died of cancer. If struggle were an animal, it would be a howling beagle. If survival were an animal, it would be, well, since humans threaten the survival of all animals, including themselves, this person can't answer that question. In battle, my weapon of choice would be outstretched open hands.
So we've come to sort of a midway point. You may have noticed that there, in great storytelling tradition, there are three pieces of paper that you have, a beginning, middle, end. So the middle piece of paper is... if you haven't gotten one, is for you to reflect on a struggle that maybe you have survived and has led you to another struggle yourself. So during this break that we're taking, be 10, 15 minutes, there's pencils. You could fill those out. And when we come back, we'll have a musical selection. And then we'll give you a chance to talk with your neighbors about what you write down, or just to think about yourself if you don't want to talk to anybody. We will not make people talk. But take a break and avail yourself of the refreshments, fill out the form, and then we'll regroup in a little bit. Thank you. Okay, everybody, I think we're gonna be ready to start the second part of the program. So we'll begin as we did before with some music from Matt and Aaron, and then we'll continue on. So. You guys ready?
Ready?
All right then, take it away.
All right, I have a couple more. A person living or dead whose struggle has touched your life in some way. Shamaya Trill Smith, my best friend, who just lost her battle with ovarian cancer. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be warm, fresh, baked cookies. My name would be Enigma. A plant whose survival strategies I admire is the pine branch I found on the ground as a child that I planted in spite of my parents' doubt, and it grew into a tree. A person whose struggle has touched your life in some way, my grandmother. If struggle were an animal, it would be a lemur with a jumping problem. If survival were an animal, it would be an armadillo. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be a lightsaber, and my name would be Empathy.
Okay, so we'll take a few minutes now for you to share with your neighbor or somebody you came with or somebody you don't know, the things you wrote down about survival and struggle for yourself. And I think it's sort of based off on the Whitman quote, which is that whatever struggle is, whatever activity is brought to fruition, that means a greater struggle necessary. It means that we're on this ongoing journey, adventure, pick your metaphor, and it doesn't stop. It just keeps going, which is a good thing. So we'll give you a few minutes to share, and if you don't and you just want to sit quietly and think, that's good too, because it's up to you. All right, so take a few and then we'll commence. We'll have two more storytellers after that. All right, so I know I broke into some good discussions, but we're going to continue on with the program. So we have some more.
All right, I have a bunch. So if struggle were an animal, it would be a chameleon, and the other person said a panda bear. If survival were an animal, it would be a cheetah or a brown bear. In battle, my weapon of choice would be water. And in battle, my weapon of choice would be a hair tie. A plant whose survival strategies I admire is a sequoia and a dandelion.
Our next teller is Sarah Suri. And she spends her time working with her therapy clients and hanging out with her husband and three pets and her kids when they're home from college. She also loves to disco dance, play the piano, attend public speaking group called Toastmasters, and has a passion for home interior decorating. The person she admires is her mother, who ended up getting sick with a chronic, extremely painful illness around the time the story was set, when she was in seventh grade. She handled her difficult situation with grace and always tried to make others laugh with her jokes and stories, even in times of personal distress. She died at the age of 50, which was 25 years ago. Her perseverance is what I will always remember and admire most about her. Sarah.
Good evening, everybody. My story is about growing up as an Indian immigrant in the 1970s in a small town in Ohio. And let me warn you right now, it is filled with teenage angst. It is February 1979. I am in the seventh grade and have been invited to Valerie Simpson's 13th birthday celebration. The whole idea of attending this sleepover party is very exciting for me, especially because Valerie is pretty and popular, and I am not. I'm very nearsighted, and I wear thick glasses. As you can see, not much has changed. I still wear thick glasses. My dark, curly hair doesn't exactly match up with the long, blonde, straight hairstyles I usually see on the cover of my teen magazine. I have braces and overnight headgear. And I often wear a t-shirt that proudly exclaims, "Tin grins are in." I am the only Indian student in my school, other than my two siblings, and I don't like being so different from everybody else. My family has immigrated to the United States from India just a few years ago. All I want is to fit in, but I struggle to make friends. So, being included on the birthday party guest list of one of the coolest girls in school is a huge deal for me. There are 2 weeks between the time I get the invitation and the actual date of the party. I spend those 2 weeks obsessing about what I will wear to this party. I decide on my long-sleeve Michael Jackson shirt, because Val and I both adore MJ, with my Jordache brand bell-bottom blue jeans that should be worn in just enough in time for the party. And my new suede earth shoes will complete my ensemble perfectly. The weekend before the party, I go shopping with my dad, and we head straight for the Sears record section, my favorite part of the mall. There, I pick out my birthday present to Valerie. The latest Michael Jackson album, of course, which I know that Val wants. Yes, sir, this sleepover party is going to be an amazing night for me, and possibly my one opportunity to get in with that in crowd. My family lives in a small, hilly town in southeastern Ohio, the type of community in which most people leave their doors unlocked, and even young children often walk to school by themselves. My mom doesn't have her driver's license yet, so my dad will be the one driving me across town to Val's house for the evening. However, I am worried that my dad might walk me to the front door and embarrass me in front of Val and her friends by speaking English in his Indian accent. So I come up with a brilliant plan, which will avoid the possibility of my dad speaking to Val or her friends at Val's front door. When it's time to leave for the party, I tell my dad, "You can just drop me off at the Bailey's twins' house. They live really close to Val's house." I know that the Baileys are also invited to this party, so I figure I'll just stop at their house first and walk over to Val's with them. Now, I'm not exactly sure which house is Val's, but I am certain that she lives on the same street as the Baileys. I don't tell anyone my plan ahead of time, and I only bring up this idea of getting dropped at the Bailey's house after my dad get into the car, because I know my mother would never approve of this idea. It is early evening and still light out when my father and I arrive at our destination. I can tell that my dad isn't very comfortable with dropping me off in front of the Bailey's house, so I assure him I'll be fine. Okay, it is snowy and freezing cold outside, but the sun has not set yet. We can see lights on inside the Bailey's house. I'll just knock on the door, the Bailey's parents will answer, and I can walk to Val's house with the Bailey twins. Then I will be on my way to Val's party and hopefully to being part of the popular group for the rest of my life. What could possibly go wrong? I insist that my dad should drive away before I walk up the steps to the Bailey's front door. After all, I have just turned 13 years old and have no need for adult supervision. I feel a keen sense of newfound independence as I wave goodbye to my father. I watch eagerly as the taillights of our blue station wagon with fake wood paneling slowly disappear down the streets. I am so relieved that my dad will not be embarrassing me with his Indian accent on my very important and life-changing night. So far, my perfect plan is working perfectly. I walk up the steps to the Bailey's front door and ring the doorbell a couple of times, but nobody answers right away. I assume they must be in the back part of the house, so I wait a few minutes and try the doorbell again, several times. Then I realize something I hadn't even thought of until just now. The Bailey's parents are not home, and the twins must have already left for Val's party. I stand on the front porch for a while, hoping that somehow the Bailey's parents forgot something and will return soon and they'll help me. Finally, I give up and I turn around to face the street. I notice that the sun is slowly starting to set, and the daylight I had counted on is quickly dwindling. I know I have to move on to Plan B. The only problem is that I don't have a Plan B. As I trudge back down the steps to the sidewalk, I suddenly remember a minor detail that had somehow slipped my mind when I originally planned this evening. The Bailey twins do live near Valerie, but their house isn't on the same street as her house. Val lives up the hill on the street directly above the twin street. The only way to get to Val's house, or even Val's street, from where I'm standing, is to climb up through a tall, steep, dark cemetery up to Val's street. Of course, I'm afraid to walk through the graveyard alone, but I don't have much of a choice at this point. How bad can it be? I start trekking up the hill, but I run into one problem right away. My earth shoes. I chose to wear them tonight more for form than function. They don't have good traction, and they keep slipping on the ice and snow. At one point, I lose my footing entirely, fall to my knees, and drop the trash bag, which holds my sleeping bag and Val's new Michael Jackson album. It glides back down the hill a few feet and lands with a thud on a large gravestone. The thought that I have possibly cracked the new Michael Jackson album that was going to help me get in with the in crowd is perhaps the worst moment of the evening for me. I retrieve the bag. I take a moment to acknowledge that this might very well be the night I will meet my maker. The cemetery is now almost pitch black. I am fairly confident that there are murderers hiding behind all the gravestones, just waiting for the right moment to get me. I'm also coming to the slow, sick realization that if I do die right now, I will never marry Michael Jackson. I am absolutely terrified. I start crying. I want to give up. There's somehow, at this point, I've made it almost halfway up that hill. Right now, I want nothing more than to be back home with my parents and my two younger siblings, eating my mother's wonderful Indian cooking for dinner. You know, I wouldn't even mind if my mom is wearing a sari tonight. For once in my life, I would welcome my parents talking to me in our Indian language that used to embarrass me. But the reality is that I am stuck by myself in a dark graveyard on the other side of town from my house with limited options and no food. As I start crying and lean on a tombstone to brace myself, I hear faint voices calling my name from the top of the hill. I find out later that my dad has called Val's house to make sure I arrive safely. So a crew of cool and popular seventh grade girls, plus Val's parents, are coming to the cemetery to look for me. I realize now that my self-created nightmare is far more embarrassing than anything my dad would have said in his Indian accent at Valerie's front door. With a huge lump in my throat, I yell back weakly to the teen search and rescue party a few times so they will know approximately where to locate me in the cemetery. Val and a couple of her friends make their way carefully down the hill to find me. They take items out of my bag to help me carry my load. The girls link arms with me, and we trudge up what seems like Mount Everest to the safety of Val's house. I have never been so happy and so humiliated at the same time. It has been 40 years now since I got lost at that dark cemetery on the way to Valerie Simpson's 13th birthday party in the middle of February of 1979. Now I'm doing the math. Has it been 40 years? Close enough. Something like that. Anyway, 35 something. Sorry. We all had a great time at the party, and I remember staying up all night eating pizza, talking, and dancing to those Michael Jackson songs. Valerie was thrilled with her new MJ album, which somehow did survive the journey, by the way. Val and her friends were very nice and welcoming to me that evening, but I never did become part of the in crowd. As much as seventh grade girls are known for being dramatic, I think maybe I brought a little too much drama to Val's 13th birthday party sleepover. Looking back, I am glad it was still the 1970s when I got lost in that cemetery on the way to her sleepover, because the Michael Jackson video Thriller had not come out yet. There was no way I would have walked through a cemetery if I thought it was filled with zombies. But then again, I think I would have done just about anything to get into that in crowd. Thank you.
All right, I have a whole bunch. A person whose struggle has touched your life in some way, Robin Williams. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be a pause button or slow motion. And a plant whose survival strategies I admire, a tumbleweed, blows wherever the wind takes it without needing anything. A person whose struggle has touched your life in some way, Flannery O'Connor. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be light, and a plant whose survival strategy I admire is a cactus. A person whose struggle has touched your life in some way, my grandma and my mom. In battle, my weapon of choice would be prayer, and my name would be peace. And if struggle were an animal, it would be a starfish when they try to open a shellfish. If survival were to be an animal, it would be a three-legged dog who keeps trying to get up and walk and live life. in a battle, my name would be Don Quixote, because I have seen that the impossible is possible.
So the last teller of the evening is Meg Saint-Esprit. She spends her time writing and chasing her four kids. She likes to write about housing justice and educational equity issues, as well as general parenting topics. A person whose struggle has touched her life in some way is her 11th grade lit teacher who introduced her to Maya Angelou, and her work has profoundly changed her life. She says, "I believed it prepared me as well to be a transracial adoptive parent to Black children and give me some window onto the Black experience and what my kids will face. If struggle were an animal, it would be an opossum. They are not glamorous, not well-loved, but tough. One sitting out my front doormat scared the crap out of me a few weeks ago, but I respected his gumption. In a battle, my weapon of choice would be, I have no idea, I hate battles, except with words. My name would be, well, I would just be me, Meg. It's taken me a long time to be okay with me, so I would stick with it. A plant whose survival strategies I admire is the spider plant. I've been trying to kill one for a very long time, and it just won't give up. Meg?"
Hi, guys. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm excited to be here. As Pam said, I have four kids. The oldest is 8. I have 6-year-old twins and a 1.5-year-old. So my story kind of opens with that. Every parent has that moment when they realize their kids have grown a little. You can't actually see them growing, but then all of a sudden something doesn't fit. It won't zipper. You can't quite get it on. With four kids, we have these moments pretty much weekly. Most recently, I realized that our youngest, the 1.5-year-old, was straining the confines of her fleece footy pajamas. She couldn't quite straighten her leg. And that's how you know it's time to move on. So we live in a 100-some-year-old drafty Pittsburgh house. We call it the Pittsburgh Special, that American Foursquare. And also, as the fourth child, she pretty much lives in her pajamas as we race around taking her three big siblings to everything. So these are not just a fashion item, they're a necessity. Now, I could have gone to the thrift store. I'm a really good thrifter, and I live in Bellevue, and we have the Red, White, and Blue, which is the best thrift store in existence. I could have gone to Target. We live on a tight budget, but we could have made it work. Instead, though, I turned to our neighborhood Buy Nothing group. I'm going to back it up here a bit and explain how this came to be. 5 years ago, we uprooted our family, which at the time there was 5 of us, from our rural Beaver County home and moved to Bellevue. We didn't know anyone at all in Bellevue, and I actually picked it based on a mom I had never met in an internet group who also was a transracial adoptive family. She's now a good friend. We knew that we could not raise our multiracial family in the stark homogenous whiteness we were living in rural Beaver County. We moved to a new community knowing not a soul. We had twin 1-year-olds and a 3-year-old, and it was incredibly isolating. It was also the middle of winter. I'm extroverted to a fault, as my husband likes to say, but there can be a loneliness in being able to chat with any person that crosses your path. I've been known to say that I have connections that are a mile wide but an inch deep. And despite the short distance of our move, I lost a lot of connections. I lost having my mom a mile down the road. I lost my church, and I lost the friends who swore they would drive down to the big city but never came to visit. I don't regret anything about our move. We are exactly where we're supposed to be, and I've made some of the most amazing friends in my entire life since we moved, but it was hard. I struggled with this lack of community. How do we create community where it doesn't exist? We bemoan, as a generation, the loss of the village. But here I was, looking at porches filled with strollers, backyards covered with Tonka trucks, people walking dogs and sitting on benches. There was a village all around me, but I didn't know how to access it. Like a true millennial, just barely, I'm an elder millennial, I turned to social media. Like the extrovert on steroids that I am, I decided I needed to find my people. And so I would just start a mom's group. Alongside another young mom that I had met, we created a hyper-local mom's group for Bellevue and Avalon. And we also launched a North Burroughs branch of the Buy Nothing Project. The Buy Nothing Project is a national organization. It is basically a hyper-local gift-giving economy where people give freely of what they have and ask for what they need. We were just the catalyst, though. These groups exploded because it turns out everyone is dying for community. It just looks different than it used to. I am fiercely independent and self-sufficient by nature, and it took a lot for me to make myself vulnerable enough to actually connect with my community. I can host every playdate, speak at every event, but actually letting people in is a lot of work for me. To acknowledge that I was drowning at home with three kids under three, that I was disconnected and disengaged, and that I didn't have it figured out was hard for me. Slowly, though, I watched community develop around me to the point where I now feel absolutely certain that my community has my back. So back to those jammies. I posted my need. I didn't need a ton of them, maybe just 7 pairs. Enough for a week, enough to procrastinate on laundry. It feels so vulnerable, right? Asking for something you need. There are families that have less than us. There's families that need more than us and struggle way more than us. But that's not solely what community is about. It's about leaning on one another, is what I have been learning. It's so much bigger than the item you're asking for. No one had all the pajamas I needed, but multiple people could spare 1 or 2 pairs. One neighbor told me she had just gone to Target and bought a 2-pack, and she'd give me one of them. So now each of our girls has matching llama pajamas. That gesture solidified for me just how entrenched I am in this village. None of us had a plethora, but we were able to make sure that everybody had just enough. A little thing that had a big impact for me. When I zip her into those jammies as glorious, glorious bedtime approaches, I feel connection. That fragile thing we as humans are seeking is solidified in that small act of love. Our community is really good at meeting big needs, whether there's a house fire, a fundraiser, a festival, or an event. We can pack a spaghetti dinner to capacity or cheer on an elementary school Halloween parade like it's Macy's quality. I think a lot of communities are really good at those things, those big things that call us all together. And I appreciate those things. They make it a great place to live. But the small, unassuming acts, they hit me so much harder. Allowing someone into my struggle for vulnerability and connection and allowing them to meet a need that I have is just truly one of the biggest hurdles I've had to overcome in my life. But the beauty that's come from it has absolutely changed me as a person. I've also really learned that there is so much love in being able to meet a need. A few months ago, another neighbor's mom passed away unexpectedly. She's the same age as me, and her mom is the same age as mine. It just felt raw and uncomfortable and painful. I'm not good with that. I say daily that I couldn't live without my mom's help. And I mean, I literally could not live without my mom's help. She comes and bails me out many days when I'm drowning in children. It's not my strong suit to be vulnerable for a friend that is navigating something that's one of my worst fears. And as I've said, vulnerability is the area where I will forever resist, which is, of course, why I volunteered to come talk tonight, you know, work on that. I never know what to say or what to do when someone is in extreme pain. It's just for me, I have a therapy degree. I have got up and talked about a million things in front of a million groups of people, but someone in extreme pain who I love is very hard for me to deal with. I offered that pat and hollow sounding, let me know how I can help, but I really had no tangible picture of what that would look like. It was just platitudes, it felt like. My neighbor, though, she has been living in and creating the same sense of community that I've been learning to trust. So my seemingly pat offer actually had meaning to her. She asked me to go to a florist and buy one Gerber daisy for each grandchild so that they could lay them on her mother's coffin at burial. The task in itself did not take me long. In walkable Bellevue, I was able to pop the baby in the stroller, go down to a florist, and ask for what I needed in less than a half hour. Walking back home with those Gerber daisies carefully wrapped in the bottom of the stroller, trying to navigate our crumbling, chewed-up sidewalks, I felt so connected through this minor act. The emotional weight of it hit me heavily. It feels so affirming to be needed and trusted in the mundane, painful details of someone's loss. I'm not sure that my friend actually gave it much thought. She had a task she didn't have time for. She might just not have had the emotional energy for it. So she asked, and I did it. But I thought about it for weeks, what it had looked like when I finally let my guard down, let people in, and allowed others to let me in also. There is so much struggle and injustice in the world that it literally overwhelms me. I realize I've led a pretty charmed life due to so many factors, generational wealth, class, and race. There's struggle I can't even begin to comprehend how people have survived. As a writer and journalist, I've had the immense privilege of helping others to tell those stories, whether it be the stories of refugees fighting for survival, a mother struggling with cancer through her pregnancy, a child with special needs. The common theme, though, in all of those stories for me is people seeking safety and authentic connection. That struggle for community, that is within all of us. When they finally find that safe, authentic community connection, that's where you really see people thrive. And that's where I saw myself thrive too when I actually did the work to get there. Thank you.
So this pretty much brings us to the end of the evening. So just to let you know that this all started out with a thought about people struggling financially. That was the starting point. And all the people that are talked tonight are all deeply concerned with this issue, with the space of low wage, poverty, homelessness. They've either worked with people or have been in that situation themselves. And we thought about it. Okay. I got to tell you this one thing. Any of you guys remember Queen for a Day? Yeah, well, that was the thing. If you're young, I'll tell you what it is. It was like the first reality show, maybe one of the first, where they get five ladies who had really sad lives and they would tell their sad stories, and then the audience would applaud, and whoever got the most applause, and they had an applause-o-meter, that's what I remember as a kid. It would go like woo-hoo, and whoever got the most applause would be the one who got to get to be queen for a day, and they would get a tiara and a washing machine. And something like that. And it was like, now that I think about it, this is a terrible, terrible show. It's horrible. And yet, I watched it as a child. I thought, oh, Queen for a Day. But anyway, we didn't want that. Okay. So the survival and struggle and survival, they're multi-layered. And you, in the end, what matters, I think, the most is taking whatever victory you can ring or whatever success you can have and then go forward and on this journey that Whitman so helpfully pointed out to us that we're on. So with this piece of paper that's going around, that if you feel like it, I would really be, we would all be curious to see what you think that, where do you think you see the journey going? What does survival look like, either for an individual or a community? And leave those thoughts with us, and we'll compile them and put them up someplace where you can check in on them. So what I'd like to do as we end is to have one more round for all the storytellers. Stand up, guys, so we can applaud you and our musicians. And thank the good people of Storyburg and Public Source for all the work they did into making this whole event happen. Yay! And I'm going to leave you with one more quote from Margaret Mead. She said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And good night. Safe home.